morning. Thank you for inviting me to be here. It's always a joy to be in the company of people who are drawn down a spiritual path and called to offer their lives through a combination of drawing nearer to the holy, to the sacred, and also to letting that kindle the light that's in them and ask that that light somehow shine in our world. We did meet almost a year ago at the annual Vedanta Society of Northern California's Memorial Day interfaith gathering. The topic that we were faced with then was spiritual oneness, which I think was probably what somehow keyed in my heart this notion of the magnificence of humanity, many flowers, one garden. And yet, as I was reflecting on this over the last few days, I thought, what a preposterous title. I mean, look at the mess we've made of this world. You just have to run through a little list. Assyria, the Central African Republic, Russia, Crimea, Kiev, anyone? And on and on. Violence all over the world, extreme poverty, oppression, prejudice, discrimination, and the destruction of this glorious earth that is our home. Who in the world could be crazy enough to even float the idea of the magnificence of humanity? We have become so clever as a species, but our wisdom has not kept up nearly well enough with our cleverness, and so we are able to do great harm so easily, and somehow the corrective forces that at least I pray every day will materialize in great strength seem largely missing. So how, I asked myself, increasingly nervous, could I possibly talk about the magnificence of humanity? Well, I'll get to that. But first, it is important to acknowledge that all over the face of this beautiful, beautiful planet, there is incredible suffering. As we sit here, comfortable, safe, in great company, we know we have sisters and brothers all over the world who live in fear that they may not survive the next hour or the next day, who go to sleep hungry and wake up hungry. Children who are born into a life of servitude and people who grow old in humiliating circumstances. Those are our sisters and brothers, and I would ask us in solidarity with them to spend a moment in silence and invite their spirits into our midst, so whatever light, whatever joy we might experience today might in some way be shared with them. Dream, dream, we're coming out of the night. Let's close our eyes and dream of the light. Dream of new tomorrows from the rubble of today. And dream of things that we can do to build a better way. Let's dream. Those words were written by a dear friend, Herm Weaver, who sings them wonderfully. I only sing when I want the room to empty out, so you'll have to bear with me. He wrote those in the shadow of September 11th, 2001, feeling that the darkness had descended and there was a very little literal rubble. And the question that challenged him was, how do we, in the midst of such darkness, not only dream of the light, but imagine what we can do to help bring the light? I'd like to talk a little today about work I've been privileged to do for the last, nearly two decades that helped me see the light that people are capable of shining and do shine in often small ways, sometimes in big ways, all over the world. Work that comes through people of different faiths seeking a common cause with each other, seeing that while we may be of different faiths, we come from the same source. And while we may be of different nationalities or cultures, we are all citizens of the earth together. So seeking to find ways to raise up that common identity so that we can celebrate our unique identities as expressions of the one. Now, some people would say being here and saying that is preaching to the choir, because that certainly is something that Swami Vivekananda spoke about again and again. And with Swamiji's approval, I'd like to share what for me is always a touchstone in the work I do, and it is the address that Swami Vivekananda gave to open the welcoming at the Parliament of the World's Religions in 1893. Sisters and brothers of America, it fills my heart with joy unspeakable to rise in response to the warm and cordial welcome which you have given us. I thank you in the name of the most ancient order of monks in the world. I thank you in the name of the mother of religions. And I thank you in the name of the millions and millions of Hindu people of all classes and sects. My thanks also to some of the speakers on this platform who, referring to the delegates from the Orient — that's not a phrase we hear much anymore — the delegates from the Orient, have told you that these men from far-off nations may well claim the honor of bearing to different lands the ideas of toleration. I am proud to belong to a religion which has taught the world both tolerance and universal acceptance. We believe not only in universal toleration, but we accept all religions as true. I am proud to belong to a nation which has sheltered the persecuted and refugees of all religions and all nations of the earth. I am proud to tell you that we have gathered in our bosom the purest remnant of the Israelites who came to southern India and took refuge with us in the very year in which their sacred temple was shattered to pieces by Roman tyranny. I am proud to belong to the religion which has sheltered and is still fostering the remnant of the grand Zoroastrian nation. I will quote to you a few lines from a hymn which I remember to have repeated from my earliest boyhood, which is every day repeated by millions of human beings. As different streams, having their sources in different places, all mingle their water in the sea, so, O Lord, the different paths which people take through different tendencies, various though they appear, crooked or straight, all lead to Thee. The present convention, which is one of the most august assemblies ever held, is itself a vindication, a declaration to the world of the wonderful doctrine preached in the Gita: whosoever come to me, through whatsoever form, I reach them. All are struggling through paths which in the end lead to me. Sectarianism, bigotry and its horrible descendant fanaticism have long possessed this beautiful earth. They have filled the earth with violence, drenched it often and often with human blood, destroyed civilization, and sent whole nations to despair. Had it not been for these horrible demons, human society would be far more advanced than it is now. That deserves repeating. Had it not been for these horrible demons, human society would be far more advanced than it is now. But their time is come, and I fervently hope that the bell that tolled this morning in honor of this convention may be the death knell of all fanaticism, of all persecutions with the sword or with the pen, and of all uncharitable feelings between persons wending their way to the same goal. It's impossible to hear those words without feeling like there's at least some justification for speaking about the magnificence of humanity. And certainly, what a beautiful sense of many flowers and one garden. And yet, it's also impossible to hear those words and think that was 1893, if the death knell of all those horrible things began tolling then. We are well over 100 years later, and yet the earth is plagued by the worst that humans may offer. Just a little sidebar. We are, for Christians, in the early part of the season of Lent. For us, it's the season that leads up to our great celebration of new life on Easter Sunday, when we believe God demonstrates God's power to draw life even from the darkness of the tomb. And if ever I needed that faith, these days certainly call for it. But Lent for us is a time of introspection, a time that is similar to what our Muslim sisters and brothers believe about their month of Ramadan, that in that time the membrane that separates the world is stretched to its thinnest. And so it is the time when it's easiest for a dedicated soul that is intent on reaching through to the divine to do that. It's a time to be still as much as you can, a time to reflect. And it also historically has been a time to reflect on the fallenness of humanity, the part of humanity that Swami Vivekananda referred to as the demons. Well, I've wanted to move a little away from that recently, and I had this message come to me that Lent begins with Ash Wednesday, when a cross of ashes is put on someone's forehead, usually with the lines spoken by the priest, "Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return." These are the lines that came to me leading up to this Ash Wednesday. This cross of ashes on our forehead calls us to remember that we come from stardust and are made to shine. And it's that I'd like to draw us toward, that we are made to be light in the world. The work I was privileged to be a part of directly as the executive director for nearly 2 decades was leading the creation of an organization called the United Religions Initiative, or URI. That's a good place to start if we want to look at the magnificence of humanity, to remember that in all our magnificent diversity, we really are one people. the spark that led to the creation of this organization came in an invitation from the United Nations to the Episcopal or Anglican Bishop of San Francisco back in 1993. The UN said, "We're coming to San Francisco in 1995 for a week to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the signing of the UN Charter in San Francisco. Would you, Bishop Swing, please host a one-hour interfaith service as part of that week of celebration?" I was just watching a video of that service yesterday to remember what that was like. There were remarkable people there. Heads of state, the Secretary General of the United Nations, all sorts of ambassadors, religious leaders from all over the world. But that was the result of 2 years of hard work. The moment that Bishop Swing was asked to host that service, he had no idea what it was going to be. He just said, "Yes, I'd be happy to." And the representative from the UN said, "We'll bring 185 nations. You please bring the world's religions." And he said, "Fine," and went home and was unable to sleep. He realized that the religions were receiving an invitation from the nations of the world to join in a celebration that for 50 years, even when they were at war with each other and no matter how imperfectly, the nations of the world had met together in a morally disciplined way to work for the peace of all. Well, what, the bishop wondered, have the religions done together to merit this invitation? The answer that kept him awake all night was nothing. We don't talk to each other. All too often, when there is conflict in the world, when hatred and violence erupt, the religions of the world are implicated not in the solution, but in the problem. So that for him sparked a commitment to find a way to bring people of different faiths together to do the kind of work the nations of the world attempt to do at the UN. Very quickly, as a small group came together around that vision, it became clear that high-level interreligious diplomacy seemed very unlikely at that point. That, I think, has changed somewhat as one of the unintended consequences of September 11th, 2001. But then there weren't a lot of high-level religious leaders who were interested in a serious interreligious work. So a vision emerged of bringing people together at the grassroots, not to formally represent their traditions, because then they would somehow be in a defensive posture, having to support what we believe and why it's right and good and true, as opposed to what someone else believes that by implication may not be right and good and true. The point was to bring people together from different faiths to say, we live in a world so deeply troubled. Is it possible for us to use the great wisdom we have each received, the impulse to make a positive difference in the world that we have each received, to use those in community and to work together, not to resolve theological disputes, not to say you're right and you're wrong, but to say there are hungry people in our community. How might we help them find ways to eat? There is a war going on here. How might we bring the different sides to this conflict together in mediation that might save the lives of countless people, the destruction of the environment, and the waste of incalculable resources that could be used to educate people? As people all over the world began to get involved, we felt it was critically important, as the UN was founded with a charter, that we would create together a charter that would not only create the vision and values for this organization, but also a sense of how we might be organized and who might belong. You may have noticed that one of the great gifts of human organization, this is a little satirical, or as my kids would say, snarky, is that almost as soon as we begin gathering, we think of the people we don't want to gather with us. You know? Who don't we want to belong here? So one of the first questions that people asked was, who gets to belong? You know, if you're honest and you stop and think for a minute, if you want to create a space and you're just going to throw the doors wide open and say, anyone who's willing to walk through that door and work in mutual respect for positive good is welcome. Is there someone or some group already you think, oh, I'd have to sit with them? If you don't manage to think of that pretty quickly, you're a rare human being. I think most of us have these at least stereotypes, and often that's what they are. They're stereotypes and they're negative. They're stories we've been told about those people. Well, we decided, we being people of all different faiths from all over the world, that we would do our best not to play that game. We said anyone is welcome. It doesn't matter if you're from a religion that is thousands of years old or from a spiritual tradition that is 10 years old. It doesn't matter if you follow an indigenous cosmovision or say you're an atheist. If you are someone who recognizes the shared humanity of the people around you and are willing to roll your sleeves up and get to work, you are welcome. We, in finally creating a charter that we signed in June of 2000, it begins with the sentence that I like to say took 4 years to write. And it goes this way. We, people of diverse religions, spiritual expressions, and indigenous traditions, that's the door open as wide as we could get it, throughout the world, hereby establish the United Religions Initiative to promote enduring daily interfaith cooperation, to end religiously motivated violence, and to create cultures of peace, justice, and healing for the earth and all living beings. When people were asked, well, how would you like to belong to this organization? What would you like it to do? One of the clear messages from all around the world was, we want to belong to something much bigger than ourselves. We want to feel we're part of something that has the potential to make change on a global level. But, always the but, right? But we don't want headquarters bossing us around. We know better where we live in our own communities, what needs to be done, and the best ways to go about organizing to get it done. We don't need anyone telling us this is the way you have to do things. And if we need help, we're smart enough to ask for it. So we created a structure that tried to honor both of those things. Local groups, which we called cooperation circles, cooperation because their central work was to work cooperatively. In a world that is torn apart by difference so often, these circles were to create a living model of how people could get along, of how people could cooperate, a model of unity in the middle of division. And a circle, because when you're sitting in a circle, everyone's a peer. There's not a boss and a bunch of followers. Although at any given moment, one person may need to take the lead. It's the lead among equals rather than one person being more important. We said, well, we want this to be easy for people to do. So what are the absolutely essential requirements to create a cooperation circle? Well, one, if we believe that interfaith cooperation is critically important, the circle ought to be an interfaith circle. So we said it needed to have at least three different traditions. Makes sense. You're modeling, let's say, Hindus, Muslims, Christians working together. And we said it could be a minimum of seven people. Doesn't need to be huge. Can be a little cell of peace and cooperation, a seed planted in the middle of a local community. When we signed our charter in June of 2000, with the notion that cooperation circles, if they agreed to operate according to the vision and values expressed in the charter and met those basic requirements, that they could do anything they wanted. They could pick their own activities. We had just over 80 founding cooperation circles from 35 countries. We discovered that in the process of asking people to imagine an organization into existence, to dream it into existence, they'd actually started becoming the organization along the way. So we had not only the words on the page, but we had the hearts and minds and hands and feet of people committed to making this organization a reality. And more than the organization, to making the work that we imagined this organization could do, to make that a reality in the world. Well, we're now approaching the 14th anniversary of the signing of that charter. And there are now nearly 650 cooperation circles in 84 countries. The work of those circles probably impacts more than 3 million people every year. And what is the work? I'll offer a couple of examples in a little more detail. But in general, as I said, it can be anything that a particular group feels is compelling to be done. There may be a group in a community that sees a lot of children in need of education and says, we want to find a way to help these children get a better education. And we'd love that education to be one that, in addition to the sort of basic subjects, as we used to say when I was growing up, reading, writing, and arithmetic, we'd like them to learn about their spiritual neighbors in a charitable way, so that they see their next door neighbors or the folks who live on the other side of town as friends who happen to be a little different, rather than as those people who believe that stuff, and how could anyone possibly believe that? Well, there are little groups around the world who are working in their own ways to do that. Or I think of a group that was in fact a school in New Delhi, that when once again the violence between people who said they were Hindus and people who said they were Muslims had exploded in Gujarat state, said, enough. I mean, kids speak the truth often, right? Enough. We don't want that to continue happening. So what can we do to show a different model? And they realized that they needed to pick some sort of action that was not controversial. Because if you pick a controversial action, then that's what people will see, and not that there are young people of different faiths working together. And they thought of two things. First, they thought, not far from this school here in New Delhi is an area that used to be an urban park. And guess what it is now? It's a trash dump. Trash dump. A landfill. And they said, what could we do to transform that landfill? So they developed a project they called Fruit Tree Saplings as Prasad. they thought, if we plant these fruit tree saplings and we nurture them, they will grow up and they will give the taste of divine sweetness to anyone who passes by, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jew, Baha'i, Zoroastrian, Jain, Sikh, on and on. It's God's goodness available to everyone indiscriminately. Isn't that one of the wonderful and annoying things about God's goodness? It's indiscriminate. Oh. So they went to work on that. The first thing they realized was, well, we can't just plant fruit tree saplings in the middle of a landfill. So they encouraged some of the adults connected with the school to reach out to people they knew, and they got a contractor to come with the big earth-moving equipment, and they got all the garbage out to start with. And then they started planting trees. In the first year, they were so proud that they'd planted all the trees, and they went off for vacation and came back, and a lot of the saplings were no longer alive. An important lesson. You can't just plant the seed. You have to plant, and then you have to tend to that. You have to nurture it. So the second year, they realized we have to include that second step. Well, that's an example of how people invited to meet a need can be creative. It doesn't have to be perfect. You can trip and fall a few times along the way, but you get up and you learn and you keep going. Another, a dear friend in the Philippines, she was not a dear friend then, I didn't even know she existed, a woman named Marites Africa, happened to go to a gathering in Manila and saw a t-shirt that had a picture of the earth cradled in two hands, and around it, symbols of many different religions. She went up to the person after this event and said, I love that shirt, please tell me about it. Well, that shirt happened to be the design that won the first t-shirt design contest the United Religions Initiative ever had. It was a global contest, and a young person from the Philippines won. And when he explained to her what this organization was seeking to be and do, she said, I want to be a part of that. I'm going to go home and I'll create a cooperation circle. So she went home. The initiative, by the way, United Religions Initiative, both that school of kids and Marites Africa took the initiative. I think that's part of what connects us to the magnificence of our humanity, is being willing to answer those sometimes uncomfortable stirrings inside us that say, there's something you can do. You can take the initiative. She went home all excited, sat down, got out a piece of paper to make a list of seven people. That should be easy. Well, that would have been easy. It was the three religions part that was hard. She is Roman Catholic in a country that last I heard was over 95% Roman Catholic. And she realized that she did not know one single person who wasn't Roman Catholic. Now, for a lot of people, that would be, well, gee, I was excited about this, but I guess it's too hard, so I'm going to give up and be done. But not for Marites. She picked up the yellow pages and started going through and finding communities from other religious faiths in Metro Manila, and then calling them, getting some people who thought she was crazy and others who were interested, and over a little bit of time managed to find 10 people from three different traditions who came together and said, well, we're interested in seeing what we could do. So these people came together and they thought, well, if we want to be a force for peace here in the Philippines, we should be peaceful ourselves. We don't want to be the kind of peacemakers who are screaming at people and throwing rocks at people in the name of peace. So they decided they would start doing what they called inner work. They met every week, and one of the people in the group would offer some sort of meditative practice from their tradition that they felt would help people find peace within, so they might then shine that peace out into the world. After they'd done that for a while, they started feeling pretty good about themselves and successful and thought, wow, this is great, but what do we do with it? The first thing they thought was, well, why don't we start teaching other people what we've learned? So they started doing workshops and inviting anyone in the general public to come and have a part of a workshop dedicated to inner peace. That took off and became quite successful. And they said, well, that's great. Now how about we try something really hard? Okay, what? Well, after they deliberated about that, they thought, there are communities in Metro Manila that are riddled with poverty, that are filled with violence, where it's almost impossible for people to live. What if we connected with one of those communities to see what we might be able to do to help the people in that community transform their community? And after a few false starts, they connected with a community that was filled with crime, with violence. The various Christian parts of that community didn't much like each other. The various Muslim parts of that community didn't much like each other. The Christians and the Muslims didn't much like each other. So they started by finding leaders from all those different parts of the community that didn't much like each other who would come together to get to know each other. Now, sometimes when you get to know someone, it's easy not to like them. But in my experience, that's rare. If you really get to know someone, you know, you dig past all of the difficult things, you find a human being like you, someone who wants to be loved, who wants to be of value, who wants to love. It's hard to find that sometimes, but if you're willing to try, you can usually get to it. Well, so they said, we want to try. Teach us this inner work you're doing. So they started Christians and Muslims together doing this inner work. And after a while, they felt, wow, you know, we could work together. We could do something in this community. So they raised resources and dug a deep water well to bring fresh water into the community for the first time. Wow, didn't that feel good? Then they went around and found some doctors and nurses who would volunteer to open free medical clinics. The government caught wind of that and said, you know, there's no place in your community where people can go to buy milk or rice, the basic commodities. Your money all goes outside your community. We would be happy to help you open a community store. One demand is that it be jointly managed by Christians and Muslims. They said, that's no problem. We have a group of Christian and Muslim leaders here. So they opened the store. It was a great success. And you know what success does. You start to see everything differently. The horrors, the demons that Swamiji spoke about start to look like something else because their power is taken away. And instead of the shadow side of humanity, you begin to see the magnificence of humanity. From there, they started a microcredit project with the government. The government said, we'll fund this for 3 years. We'll give you this much the first year, this much the second year, this much the third year if you meet your benchmarks. Well, in the first year, they met their benchmarks in 6 months. And the government was so impressed that they said, you know, there are 3 other communities here in Metro Manila we would ask you to work with. We can look at the world around us and let it fill us with despair. It's easy to do. It's something I struggle with, to be honest, every day. It's easy to do. But it's also the path to defeat. It's the path into despair. And I don't believe we're put here on earth to be defeated and to live in despair. The other side is that we can dream. We can let our imaginations soar. We can look at the world around us and not see problems and defeat, but possibilities and victories. And we can say that in addressing these challenges and trying to create the dreams in reality, we can come together in new community that manifests not only our magnificence as human beings, but the notion that we are all, in our remarkable diversity, flowers in God's one garden. I'd like to share words that Maritess Africa wrote on September 11th, 2001. The words from Swami Vivekananda, you probably know, were written also on September 11th. So this is September 11th, 122 years later. Dear fellow workers in the light, in the wake of the tragedy in New York and Washington, D.C., we, the members of the Peacemakers Circle in the Philippines, wish to express to the people of the United States our deepest sympathy. It's worth noting that at this point, the Peacemakers Circle was working on inner work. All the rest of their story that I shared with you lay ahead of them. They didn't know that, but it did. We pray that in the midst of this darkness, the light of divine wisdom and love will prevail and shine forth in our hearts. Let us remain steadfast in our faith. Let us not allow the darkness of fear, anger, and hatred to overcome us. Let us continue to pray and to journey in peace together as one earth community. Many lives have been lost in this tragedy. The scale and magnitude of the destruction is awesome and horrifying. The process of meeting justice and of healing will have to begin anew when the smoke is cleared and the rubble removed. But the night will be long, and the darkness will settle for a while. Yet hope must not be lost. We, people of diverse religions, spiritual expressions, and indigenous traditions all over the world, must continue to believe in our shared vision and work to make peace our every step. Perhaps, one day, this tragedy will be remembered as the end of the old era of conflict and violence and the beginning of a new era of peace building in our midst, especially in the arena of international relations. Do you hear the echo? Our global movement of peoples of diverse religions and beliefs must now rise from the rubble and bring to the fore the highest values and teachings of our faith in dialogue and initiatives that promote peace and healing of the earth and all beings. We pray for all the people suffering from this tragedy in the USA and all over the world. We pray that divine justice, peace, and healing may prevail all over the earth. Back in 2006, Maritess and some of her colleagues were part of a peace-building training that the United Religions Initiative did over the space of 2.5 years. Another one of those groups in the training was from Kerala State in India. They hosted one of our training sessions, and while we were there, we all got on a bus and drove down to the tip, the southern tip of India, and got on a ferry and went across to Vivekananda's rock, where Swami Vivekananda went in retreat before he came to this country for the Parliament of the World's Religions. And after sitting there in silence, with only the noise of the waves and the sound of the seabirds, we read in sequence Swami Vivekananda's words and then Marites Africa's words, each in their own way, coming over a century apart, I think reflecting the wisdom and desire of the source that put us all here. We cannot let the darkness or the appearance of darkness defeat us. We cannot rest comfortable in our own little enclaves while the world needs so much. I believe we're called to go as deeply inside as we can, to find the light, the goodness, the love, the joy within ourselves. Not only so we can feel good about ourselves, but I think that's really important. Very little positive is done in the world by people who don't feel good about themselves, because we are God's people. To find that inside and then to ask, how do we shine that out in the world? By prayer, certainly. And for some people, that is their vocation. For many others, it's by prayer and. What's the and? We're limited only by our power to imagine, to dream, and to follow our imagination and dream with commitment. So this morning, I invite all of us on that whole journey. For me, that's a good Lenten journey, to go as deeply inside as possible and then to come out with a renewed commitment to let the light that I've been given shine as brightly as possible in the world. And when that happens, we see the world differently. And slowly by slowly, the world becomes a different place where we do see the magnificence of humanity. And we do not only imagine, but we see that we are beautiful flowers in one garden. Thank you.